You're listening to a stage talk titled We Are Bellingcat, Q&A session with Elliot Higgins. For our final stage talk of the year, we shook up the format a little and invited our founder, Elliot Higgins, to come and answer audience questions. 2024 is the 10th year of Bellingcat's existence, and we thought it would be nice to mark the end of that 10th year with the man it all started with. Grab some popcorn and listen in. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday the 12th of December 2024 in the Bellingcat Discord server. All right. Okay. I think we'll probably have quite a lot of questions and conversation for this particular session. So I want to start off straight away, if that's all right with everybody. So hey everyone, welcome to this special stage talk Q&A session with the one and only Elliot Higgins. This is to mark the end to our 10th year as an organization. And if you haven't heard that it's our 10th year yet, where have you been? If you didn't know already, Elliot is the founder of Bellingcat. He started his open source research journey in the early stages of the conflict in Syria when he started blogging about open source images being shared online from the conflict. Then, later, as his and his fellow contributors' stories started hitting the headlines, he launched Bellingcat in 2014, a new website intended to provide a place for readers to learn how to do their own open source investigations and to contribute their own investigative work. Flash forward 10 years, and Bellingcat still runs on that same philosophy. An investigative collective of researchers, investigators, and citizen journalists brought together by a passion for open source research, with over 30 full-time staff, including myself, and contributors in more than 20 countries. Today, we'll be talking about the best-selling book, We Are Bellingcat, published in 2021, that Elliot wrote to cover the founding of Bellingcat. And we will also be discussing how the world Bellingcat is operating in has changed over the last decade. We will be saving a huge chunk of time for questions. This is really more of a Q&A session than our usual stage talks. So please make sure to pop your questions in the chat. Elliot, over to you. Why did you first decide to write We Are Bellingcat?
It was really, to me, seems like a good time to write down the adventures that we had had over the last few years. Really from 2018 onwards, we were changing as an organization. I think that was the old Bellingcat, I think, was captured quite well in the Bellingcat Truth in a Post-Truth World documentary. And then a few years after that, I had the opportunity to write the book. I felt that I wanted to reflect a lot of what had changed in Bellingcat since that documentary, because that was like the kind of last public record of what, I guess, Bellingcat was. I also wanted to talk a bit about the future of Bellingcat. A lot of the work we're doing now is stuff that I mentioned towards the end of the book. We're doing more work in education, for example, working with secondary schools and universities. So for me, it was really just an opportunity to kind of make a record of that. Plus, I was asked to write it, which is always handy when you're trying to get anything out there.
I know there's some people from the book club in the audience. So if you have any questions, because I know the book club was also previously read it, and I know that they had some previous questions as well from the last read through, so please pop them in the chat. But just to start, Joseph Brooker asks a really interesting question. What would you recommend to researchers interested in matching Bellingcat's rigor and impact, but who are interested in other subjects?
So first, have a look around at what work is being done already. I often, when I'm talking to various people, they really see us in the context often of conflict and Russia are kind of the two areas they always kind of think of in terms of Bellingcat. But if you look through the work that we've published over the years, we've done quite a wide variety of subjects. A lot of environmental work that's been done, and we've got some great contributions on the websites there. That's something worth reading. I mean, you can apply open source investigation to a whole range of topics. A few years ago, during COVID, I was contacted by an organization called Lost Dog, who specialized in helping people find their lost and stolen dogs. And we actually used a technique that was developed by one of our colleagues, Timmy Allen, to decipher number plates using machine learning. And you just use this in the murder of Pavel Sherbet in Ukraine. And we used that same technique to read the number plate on a car that was speeding away with a stolen dog. So just because a technique is used in one context doesn't mean it can't be used in a very, very different context. So just look at, the subjects you're interested in. I think, looking back at the work of Bellingcat, could you apply that technique, that idea, or that skill to what we're doing? I'd also direct people to use our Bellingcat toolkit, because we've just updated that with AI's powered search engine. So you can actually ask it a question and it will help you recommend or find the recommended tools to maybe find a solution to that, rather than you having to figure out which tool you need first. So I'd recommend using that one as well.
I just linked the GQ magazine that mentions that lost dog story, but did we publish it on Brian Moses or on Bellingcat at the time?
No, it was kind of a bit of a weird one, because it ended up being quite easy, because there were three in total. The first one we got the number plate for, and the police actually followed that up. Now, the police were not looking to stolen pets whatsoever. They have no interest in that. So the only reason they followed it up is because we gave them the number plate of the car and we could match it to the MOT database that's public. Then the second one, they were actually trying to ransom the dog to the people they'd stolen it from. So there again, we very quickly were able to identify them and say, hey, is this your house? And, you know, they've quickly returned the animal. In the third case, they didn't even contact us, because when they were contacted by the kidnappers of the dog saying we want money for it, they just sent the previous two examples where we'd found the address and they just gave it back straight away. So it kind of just happened. And because it involves kind of private individuals and it's not really like a super newsworthy thing, or at least I didn't think it was at the time, we didn't publish anything on it. But GQ, you got some words out of it.
Quite a few questions coming through in the chat now. Christy asks, how can technical writers get involved in open source research / Bellingcat? And Christy, I would definitely point you towards Galen, if Galen's around in the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when we've been doing our work, we've had to, I don't think we've got anyone in the organization, or very few people in the organization, who are researchers with a professional journalism background. So for us, that's relied very heavily on the editors being able to translate their research into something that's in more of a publishable format, and also learn as researchers, you know, what kind of works in the shape of an article. I think when you're learning to write like this, a lot of it is being able to kind of state your case in a very clear way, showing what evidence you're doing, your analysis. And that's something that's really a learned skill. I mean, if you look at my early Brown Moses blog publications, they're not great. There's a lot of grammar and spelling mistakes, I will admit. I have learned the difference between where you use an apostrophe in its, which is quite important, I find. So really, a lot of it is just going through the process of writing. Just kind of finding your own space as well to do that. Don't be afraid to have, you know, your own blog where you're writing stuff up, because that process of doing it is what's going to kind of teach you how you can communicate that to people. And when you might be doing something that's quite a unique thing, like, you know, I was doing that, you know, 12 years ago, it's useful to have that experience of trying to communicate that to other people. And that's not something that, when you're dealing, I think, with open source investigation, can always be taught, because, you know, there's only so many people who are practitioners of this, and most of them don't come from those professional writing backgrounds.
Yeah, there's only a few of us from the journalism space, as you said, which I think it makes it such a diverse and really interesting outlet to work in, actually, because you have so many different ways of problem solving, thinking about an issue, which I think is really useful, actually, when it comes to this kind of work. Just as we're talking about the early days of Bellingcat, Joseph Brooker again asked a question about the earlier days. They said, Bellingcat dove headfirst into highly contentious territory. How did you protect yourself and your team early on before having the same resources and public support you do now?
I'm not sure we did, really. We kind of just did it. I mean, early Bellingcat, you know, 2014 to 2015 was really just me and then the volunteers that came from the community that was looking at MH17, and then that kind of evolved into a broader investigation into Ukraine. But everyone was still a volunteer. I think in terms of legal protection, I think maybe we got lucky more than anything, that, you know, people didn't decide to sue us even when we were right. I think the only legal threat we got early on was there was an article on the watches worn by drug lords in Mexico. And we got an email from one of the watch companies saying that they would like us to take the post down because the guy in the post isn't a drug lord, even though he clearly was. And it was besmirching their reputation. So I thought, you know, I don't have the money to fight a legal battle, so I just removed that from the list. But I think that's the only time we've had to do anything like that from a legal threat. In terms of security, I think that's certainly something that's we've become more aware of. In 2012, I was, you know, writing the Brown Roses blog, but it was kind of just me and me doing my thing. But in 2013, following the publication of the stories on the smuggling of weapons to the Syrian opposition, which got in the New York Times, I started being invited to events with activists and journalists where there was an element of that that was about security training. So I learned an awful lot from people from organizations like Tactical Tech in Germany, or the OCCRP used to talk a lot about security, how to look after yourself. And those lessons are ones that I still use today. And now more recently, we have Hisham, our security officer, who's always making sure that we're aware of how we should be looking after ourselves, our equipment, and our online presence.
What I really love about these stage talks is that we answer a question, and then in the chat, other people give their advice. So just going back to Chrissy's question on the technical writer, Hypnotoad has put, RE technical writer question, writing toolkit entries is open to everyone theoretically, and we need all the help we can get. Please do get involved with that. If you want to get involved with the Bellingcat Toolkit, do contact us. We are looking for people to continuously help build that and keep it running. And then Sarah says, I'm a working technical writer, and I think working with other open source researchers who are generally not great at speaking in regular terms anymore and speaking geolocational tool language is a path forward. It's what I do. Johnny Gizmo also says, without technical writers, there'd be complete chaos, which I think is very, very true. We've got so many other questions, and Lee actually asked a question about the future. And I hate to jump from the past to the future, but I think this is quite interesting. During your talk in London for the UK OSINT industry, you emphasized education as the best solution for disinformation, but acknowledged how hard it is to change people's habits. Why not focus on targeting major industries like Google and Facebook for long-term impact instead of education, which seems to have a limited reach? Wouldn't industry partnerships create a broader, more global effect? I know this is something you've been looking into quite extensively, so I'll give you the floor.
I'm not against industry partnerships, but I've been engaged with Google and Twitter from really, I think, 2013, 14 onwards in various ways. The problem is their interests kind of, there's an ebb and a flow to it. Sometimes they're really interested, and then sometimes they aren't interested. The period of 2014, I was kind of invited to the Google offices in San Francisco and New York. I got to see, you know, their Lego room and their big canteen and all that stuff. But, and they were really, really interested in the work I was doing. But then as kind of ISIS appeared and suddenly the Arab Spring started seeming like a lot more of a scary situation than they appreciated, and they realized that there was that kind of role for them. Then with 2016 and the US elections and, you know, Russian disinformation, their kind of focus kind of shifted more to kind of really, I think, protecting themselves to a certain extent because of the amount of new issues this was kind of creating. In terms of education, I mean, the work I've been doing so far has really been engaging people at different levels. It's about, you know, not just talking to, you know, academics and teachers, but also talking to policymakers about explaining why this is important. A lot of my work at the moment is actually, I'm working on a paper at the moment with Dr. Natalie Martin at Nottingham University, where we're kind of breaking down what information disorder is, where it comes from, and trying to shift the attention of the focus of the kind of counter disinformation community, as you could call them, away from this idea that it's foreign actors like Russia who are the main drivers of this, and actually show that actually this is a social issue where there's various factors that drive the creation of true believers. These are the people who will, you know, create and spread disinformation because they think they're actually trying to find the truth. Often they're seeing it through a lens that has been really kind of warped by a deep distrust in sources of authority on any topic. And if you recognize that pattern, you can see it repeating time and time again over a range of different topics, everything from flat earthers to Syrian chemical weapons denialists. You actually see the kind of raw components of where they become what they are the same. It's just different flavors of the same thing. So actually recognizing that will first allow us to understand the problem and then start thinking, how do we address this? And I think education is essential because we're moving from a system of a kind of top-down gatekeeped information model where it's newspaper editors, it's the government who decide what information that we get to see as the public, to a more peer-to-peer model. And that's something that's affecting Generation Alpha really in particular, because their primary source of information is social media. And it's when you're talking to organizations that are talking about countering disinformation, and they're saying, we've got, you know, teach young kids how to fact check headlines. I find that ridiculous, because when are they going to be reading headlines in their life? They're not, because they don't consume media through the traditional mediums that older generations are used to. So we need to adapt to that. It's not just the matter of saying, hey, this is what TikTok is, kids. It's actually saying, how do you actually live in an information environment? How do you teach and educate in an information environment, which is this kind of peer-to-peer model, rather than, you know, hoping that it all goes back to how it used to be with newspapers and TV news dominating the media landscape.
And also where people are being continuously pushed into silos as well. You know, it's not just a general news show that gives you everything at 6 o'clock. All the news of the day, you know, you're engaging with the news that's relevant to you and only to you, because you're being pushed down a silo on those social platforms as well, which is another thing that news organizations have to deal with as well, as a new concept of serving news to audiences who want to hear news that's relevant to them only, or it would fit within their already narrower worldview. I think that's something.
And I think they're
considered.
When we're talking, so the root cause a lot of reasons why people get drawn into you know, these true believer communities that, you know, really believe that the earth is flat, or, you know, Syria didn't use chemical weapons, is because they have a lack of trust in mainstream sources of authority on those issues. That's then kind of codified by some form of crisis, and that could be political, social, it could be a war, it could be, you know, COVID. Then they find online spaces where there's people have already kind of had those discussions about, yes, you're right, that, you know, you're correct that, you know, Assad didn't use chemical weapons, or vaccines, you know, have microchips in them, or whatever that might be. And you also have within there, through this kind of algorithmically and community-led process of being gradually exposed to more and more extreme content. It's very much similar to the pyramid of radicalization model, where, you know, if you take the example of COVID-19, I mean, lots of people would have Googled, you know, back in the COVID times, that, oh, are vaccines safe? Because, you know, mRNA, you know, all that stuff. But most of those people are going to be people who at least have enough trust in medical professionals and the government and the media to believe what they're saying. But there'll always be a subset who don't, and then they will be kind of served by the algorithm, slightly more extreme content, and encounter communities with slightly more extreme beliefs. And that process repeats again and again until they've gone, you know, from being told that, you know, maybe having vaccines at the same time might be a bad idea, and maybe vaccines could cause autism, maybe vaccines had microchips in them, maybe vaccines are going to be activated by 5G towers, and that leads to people burning down 5G towers, of which there was about 100 incidents of that happening in the UK during that period. And that's because those people are particularly vulnerable to those messages, because they have that deep-rooted sense of distrust, but also because they're looking for affirmation and community, and the internet is very, very good at providing that, as long as you follow the line of the community. Because once you start straying from outside the ethos of that community, you become an outsider, you get attacked. So your own personal values are very much tied to that. And we need to understand that process to actually address disinformation and stop pointing the finger to outside actors who do exist and take advantage of that, but I don't believe are the primary drivers of why there is so much information disorder.
Yeah, just on that, just as we're on this conversation, someone's asked, are you concerned that a pointed focus on the right versus the left increases the distrust behind the misinformation cycle you mentioned?
Yeah, I think so. I always try to avoid thinking in terms of right and left when it comes to this, because it affects everyone. And certainly there's communities within who would consider themselves left or right, who are more vulnerable to that, who you know, use that to their own advantage. But it's not something that's only right-wing or left-wing people are affected by. And I personally find this idea of right-wing and left-wing in the modern context may be something that isn't very helpful, because that again relies on old models of communication and power that I think are shifting dramatically. It's not about, you know, I'm you know, I'm right wing, but now I've decided to become left wing. It's like, I'm in this bubble, this bubble, this bubble. You know, I'm being served this information by the algorithm. I'm being part of these communities. And they might, some of them fit into more traditional ideas of left wing and right wing. But I think that starts becoming a kind of perceptual cage that we can find ourselves trapped in if we keep on thinking about it in those terms. We need to think about it in the kind of, you know, what is the raw material of this? What is, why do we get drawn into these ways of thinking in the first place? And you can find, I think this is often why you have so much talk about horseshoe theory, you know, especially around things like Syria. Maybe there's actually something else going on there that isn't really about the political spectrum. It's about, you know, how we interact with each other through algorithms, through communities, how we react to our sense of distrust in those mainstream sources of authority that have previously really dominated the information landscape, and in a situation where they don't dominate in the way that they used to.
Absolutely. Moving away slightly from disinformation and possibly the future of media and consumption as well, I want to go back to getting started in the open source research, just because we had quite a few questions on that particular topic. Tom from Mombasa asked, as a young journalist getting into OSINT reporting, which skills / techniques do you think are useful right now? I'm from Kenya, so if you can keep your response with this in mind, that will be really helpful.
The core technique anyone needs to learn is geolocation. It's any video or photograph that can't be geolocated, it can't be confirmed it's from a location. In the work we do, it has very little value. So that's something that has to be really, you know, a prime thing that you learn and understand in this work. Chronolocation is also very important. Learning the time where something is taken is very important. It's kind of those building blocks to recreating your understanding of what happened at an event is very, very important. So those, I would say, are the primary skills that you need to learn, develop, and concentrate on. And you can do that with a lot of events. If there's, conflict incident, if there's, a riot, if there's, robbery or whatever it may be, if there's videos and photographs of it, just collect it all, geolocate, chronolocate, and understand the timeline and the space in which it's taking place. If you look at the work of forensic architecture, for example, they kind of show what you can do when you take that to its most, I guess, maximum extreme. For example, when they did the work on the Beirut blast, they did a really good job of reconstructing, you know, the layout of that building, where stuff was within that building, the timeline of how it actually ignited and the explosion. But those are still based on those kind of very two basic or those two essential skills that you need as an investigator. So get that right. And then the rest to do with ship tracking, plane tracking, whatever it may be, that's great as well. But I would say that's the kind of key skills that anyone should learn.
Absolutely. I was actually speaking to Mike Gambo, who is the only open source researcher at The Nation in Kenya earlier today. He's going to be coming in next month to do a stage talk for us, which is fantastic. But if you're looking for inspiration on in Kenya specifically, have a look at this story, 8 Hours of Rage, by The Nation. It's a fantastic example of how you can do open source research within the country. And it's a great timeline of the protests that happened 100 days ago. Please do have a look at that. There's another question actually related. Somebody said, hi, I'm from Bangladesh and OSINT isn't really practiced here much, but there's definitely a growing interest. Do you have any suggestions on how to create a local OSINT community?
It's really finding what is a common interest to everyone who's part of that. Really, when the communities that arose on social media appeared, it was because there was a big incident that gave people something to focus on. I think MH17 was really the greatest example of that, that it brought two people together in these online spaces that meant they could collaborate together in a way that really wasn't possible before. Certainly with Syria in the years prior to 2014, open source investigation was still quite a lonely pursuit, I would say. But it was really 2014 where suddenly with a really big incident, everyone kind of came together around that. And that might mean that you're exploring local networks where people care about something that's actually a local issue, where you can apply these same skills. The work that we're doing at universities at the moment to build curriculum around open source investigation and set up investigative labs at those universities, for me, part of that is engaging with local issues, you know, engaging with local media, NGOs, even local schools to work on issues that they care about. And I think that's a really great way to actually give people a reason to do it, because not everyone's interested in everything that's going on in the world, you know, internationally, but they might be interested on something that's quite, you know, straightforward. One example I really like is we worked with an organization called the Student View, and what inspired me to first reach out to them is they what they've been doing is going into schools where they teach young people how to do investigative journalism skills and team them up with a journalist. And there was a school in Bradford where the students were really concerned about high-speed police chases in the local areas. So they were told by the journalist, you can do a freedom of information request. And that allowed them to find out that it was one of the highest rates in the country, which became a local story reported by the journalist they were working with and eventually a national story. And that changed the behavior of the police and had to actually make them have, you know, responsibility for that. Now, if you look at those students, they were in a power dynamic before that where it was very one-sided. They felt they had no power. And what this showed them is, yes, you can actually be empowered. And I think that's something that's actually really, really important, especially to young people at the moment, when because we do have this kind of shifting model of information from the gatekeeper to the peer-to-peer, that they feel less and less connected to kind of the older generations and those power structures, because it's not something they interact with. It's not something they can see themselves as part of, but they have these online spaces. And I think it's important to turn those online spaces into something where they can be empowered to have a real impact in their own communities and in their own lives.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good example. We've had quite a few people suggest things about the geolocation point as well that you made. Sam Dirk from Sky News says it's the easiest way to sell to a newsroom, actually, beyond fancier outputs. If you can verify footage and work things out, you can save them a lot of time and money. Galen's also relayed the fact that we actually have an ongoing Bellingcat challenge. You can go to challenge.bellingcat.com and have a little go at some geolocations that we've put out there for you. And you can do one a day, or you can race through all five every week. And each week there's a new set of challenges coming out. So please do check that out. There's a huge community in this server actually going through them together. We've had quite a lot of questions on Syria, obviously, with the recent news. And one of the questions said, Syria is a big part of where you started, Elliot. Will recent events change what open source can contribute to that region?
Possibly. I mean, I've spent since 8 o'clock this morning just working on just endless calls about Syria. First, it was all about the possible sighting of Austin Tice and verifying whether that was true and communicating that to the right people when it wasn't. We've been discussing in the kind of accountability community the question of all these documents that you're seeing being rifled through at the moment, how can they be preserved, how can we document that, and there's, you know, all kinds of efforts that are kind of very quickly trying to organize around that. In terms of what open source can offer, we're having a discussion at the moment about can we capture some of this stuff that's being shared online, the documents, for example, or the release of prisoners where, you know, these are people who are kind of just wandering out onto the streets and may not even have homes to go to, but we want to make sure this is all collected. So at some point in the future, this can be used for accountability. We now have the fact that, you know, there might be a lot of documentation that's discovered that is relevant to incidents that we've investigated in the past. That might actually give us an idea of the command structures that are behind, you know, the orders to use chemical weapons. And that's really, really important for accountability processes. It's very rare you have an accountability process where you can say a country did it. You need to be able to demonstrate, you know, what was the chain of command, who was directly responsible for each part of that process. So I think there's still a lot to offer. I think everyone has been caught by surprise with what's happened over the last 2 weeks, and especially in the last 72 hours. It just feels like a million things are happening all at once. So, you know, happening before Christmas as well. I think a lot of people are reconsidering their holidays at the moment. But I think in the new year, once the dust has settled, we've got a better idea of how much accessibility HGS is going to be giving human rights researchers and other organizations to start collecting evidence from crimes. I think we'll start seeing, you know, understanding the impact of open source investigation on that a lot more.
Why was Syria a focus for you when you first started? Why was it why did you first start that kind of exploration? Just going back to kind of some of the points we started this conversation with.
Yeah, it was really kind of an evolution from where I started seeing the stuff first coming from Egypt in 2010 and then Libya. And Libya was really where I first started figuring out how to do geolocation. And that was really to win arguments with people in the comments of the Guardian Middle East Life blog more than anything. And I will argue with people to, as anyone who follows me on Twitter for a long time. And so in a way, my work has really been going from arguing with people on internet conversations to arguing with governments about the facts that are out of various incidents. And then really, and I started getting into doing this. Syria was the conflict that was kind of really escalating at the time. So it was kind of just a natural progression. There was no, I had no kind of interest or even knowledge of Syria really before that. It's just there was all this video stuff coming out of it. And I realized eventually, very quickly, in 2012, when there was the Hula massacre, just after I started the Brown Moses blog, that there was this kind of very systematic way in which you could track this open source content by following the YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter accounts associated with various groups. And I think I was the only person who had, well, one of a very small number of people who had realized that was possible. So I could watch this information coming through and identify things that I could start looking at. And to begin with, that was arms and munitions used in the conflict, because no one was really saying what weapons are being used by these rebel groups. Do they have tanks or rocket launchers, or do they just have machine guns? And then chemical weapon use came along, and that was another really big thing that I got involved with. So it kind of just developed bit by bit over time. And as I developed my skills by writing on my blog, I was able to do kind of more and more complex investigations.
Lee asks, I'd love to argue with Elliot on topics. How can I link with him?
I've made a promise to myself and to the social media policy that I'll try not to engage too much in arguments anymore. And I think the problem with arguing on social media platforms is you're often arguing with people who've got the same brain chemistry, I think, is me, where they just like to keep arguing and arguing and arguing just because it's stimulating for the brain. And I'm trying to crack down on that in my own life a bit.
There are ways to argue your way to winning. There was, Sarah said, Elliot, I'm going to say you won that argument. We've heard it here first. Passive aggressiveness leads to passion in life, and Bellingcat, apparently. But that's good. So we've had a talk about Syria. We've had a talk about the beginnings of Bellingcat. We've had a few questions on how you craft your stories. So Joseph again said, what helped you most in crafting your arguments analytically? And we were talking about technical writing earlier, but how did you get better at writing stories and actually writing up your findings?
I think because I set myself a challenge that every day I would try and post something on the Brown Moses blog. And early on, often that was just links of interesting videos that showed weird things rather than any real analysis. But bit by bit, I started kind of making it a bit more detailed. Like I start putting geolocations in a video. Now, not many people may have been interested in that video, but it's what I was interested in. I would also advise anyone, don't go chasing other people's interests. Just do the stuff you're interested in. Because with open source investigation, one day you're going to be digging through hundreds and hundreds of links trying to find one photo that helps you make your case. So I would say, you know, first of all, find something you actually really, really care about, that you care about the details. Maybe find people you want to have arguments with on the internet, because that helped with me when I was doing this work. But don't feel like you have to do massive 100-page reports with your first thing. It can literally just be one simple geolocation. But the process of writing it down in a way that you can see makes sense to other people, just write it down and read it through and say, if I knew nothing about this video or geolocation, would this be something that I would understand? Use lots of colored boxes on your satellite imagery and your videos and your photos, because that's always really helpful. But yeah, really think about when you're writing how step-by-step you're doing it. And then as you keep doing that, what you'll find is, first of all, you'll start challenge yourself. Think about how someone on the internet who's arguing with you in bad faith would attack your work, and then start trying to address those issues within how you're writing it, and try and do that in a natural way so it comes up naturally in the language, rather than saying, here's a list of things why you're wrong, you, it's on the internet. Just try and like think about how, you know, the bad faith actors are going to respond to your work, and then that'll help you kind of guide that what you need to do to kind of answer that in what you're writing.
Absolutely. And also, there's not just one way to tell a story either. As a social media editor, I have to say, video is leading the way. And there's lots of open source researchers now using video to tell stories too. So don't be afraid to also follow that medium. Lots of different ways to tell a story and explore them. People want to engage with this kind of research. And in fact, geolocation efforts are hugely popular on TikTok. There's so many influencers using our methods to amaze people about how you can find the location of someone's toilet from an image that they've posted on TikTok, for example. So there is appetite for this kind of content. You just got to think about ways to market it to them, which I think is something also to add. Sam Dirk asks an interesting question. How do you manage working in a space where periods of very intense work are almost completely unpredictable?
Oh, yeah, that's really dick. I mean, the last week has been a good example of that. I had set the last 2 weeks of my working year, this week and next week, to be quiet so I could catch up with my paperwork. But that's all been blown out for the water by recent events in Syria. I think a lot of it is making sure that you do have kind of space to do the work, that you aren't filling your schedule up with lots and lots of meetings. As now in my position, I have to have lots and lots of meetings, so I can't really schedule kind of research time for myself. A lot of it for me now is actually more coordinating other people, connecting people, getting them to figure out ways that they can work together rather than being able to do the research myself. And I do miss being able to do research. But I think a lot of it is making sure that you keep space aside. Like, don't have a day where you've got like a meeting, a 2 hour gap, and then another meeting. Try and have all those meetings on the same day and leave a full day open for anything that could happen. And if it ends up nothing's happening on that day, you can go and just answer your emails or do some admin work. But then if something does happen on that day, you've got the space to do it. So I always try and plan my week that I've got busy appointment days and quiet days where I can either be catching up with stuff, doing paperwork, or I can start diving into stuff that requires attention on that day.
Another question on the tools. What advice, tools, resources would you recommend for part-time OSINT practitioners, hobbyists, to take their skills to the next level past the fundamentals? So once you've mastered geolocation, what do you do next? What's the advice? What's the tools? What's the resources?
I would learn about marine traffic, flight traffic, firms in particular, learn about the satellite imagery sites, which will probably pick a pre-geolocation. But that kind of those kind of sensing sites, I think, are very, very useful. And I think probably in the work that we do, I would say that's probably after geolocation and chronolocation, the next level of tools where you would start encountering the interesting stories. And where I think in our work, we've probably found the most kind of stories at that kind of next level. So those are the ones I would go for next. And they're quite straightforward to use once you actually get into them. They look a bit intimidating at first, but when you start learning how to do that, I think you can kind of pick up a lot there.
And if you are getting into those, we do have a fantastic community for all of those things within the Discord. You can find the channels related. I'm sure the mods will pop them in the chat for me in a second for all of those topics. And we have guides on the website as well that you can go through on flight tracking, on tracking oil spills, even if you want to look at oil spills in the water via satellite imagery, on using satellite imagery, and everything under the sun you can possibly dream of is all on our website. Please do check that out. We've got an interesting question about the development of tech. How do you think, the girl with what I asks, how do you think OSINT as a skill set will change in the age of AI and LLMs, especially in the context of quantum computing nearing consumer release?
I do wonder, because I think there's not much attention or investment in those areas at the moment. I think there's been some use of machine learning in the past that's been interesting. So there's things like V-Frame, which has been used by the Syrian archive, which they trained. They created 3D models of cluster munitions and then trained with machine learning a way to detect that in the videos they had in their archive. And something similar was done by Forensic Architecture for one of their pieces in Ukraine, where they were trying to identify specific types of tanks using a similar system. It's still, I think, quite limited in terms of anything beyond that. I think the thing with open source investigation is there's not a lot of money in it. So, you know, these big firms that are looking for ways to make loads of money aren't even thinking about us at the moment. I think a lot of it is going to be more about triage and dealing with large sets of data and identifying things in those large sets of data for the moment. I have not really seen anything yet. And if anyone has seen anything like it, but anything from the world of AI that has particularly excited me in terms of the work that we do. And ultimately, a lot of the work we do is, whilst we can create tools to simplify some of it, you know, maybe make it easier to search satellite imagery. There's been stuff that's useful already, like PeakVisor, that's been a really useful tool that's saved a lot of researchers a huge amount of time, even if they don't realize it. That, I think, at the moment is a real limit on what we're able to do with AI. And I to be honest, I don't think about it too much in the context of open source investigation, because I think it's people's brains that are way more important. Because sometimes when you're doing this work, you've got to make leaps and make connections, or even swap tiny groups of pixels in a picture that otherwise would mean nothing to any machine.
Yeah, AI models aren't there yet with geolocation. And we've tested a few. You can see on our website a few tests that have been done by various members of Bellingcat. But it is something that's in development. We have, myself and Galen had talks with some individuals who are building AI tools for open source methods recently. But it, again, there's not any that are convincingly strong at this point. If you do come across one, please pinpoint it to us. We'd love to have a go and see if it can take our jobs. Related to that, there was another question saying, what new technologies do you think researchers are underutilizing? Where are the missed opportunities when it comes to new tech?
Well, I think it's that kind of, those kind of machine learning systems that can deal with large amounts of videos. Those are quite useful. Like we used Microsoft Azure, or we've played with it a bit in the context of the January 6th riots, because we had so many videos that we're trying to connect to each other, and we tried to use the tools there. So there's potential there. But a lot of this requires quite a lot of very specific knowledge and access to very specific tools that aren't really freely available to most people. So I've, for me, it's more about creating the opportunities to create tools for very specific situations. But part of the reason that I'm keen on doing our kind of university project where we're building these investigative hubs is that if we're working with universities, we can connect them to computer science departments where they can develop the kind of tools that we already do with Bellingcat sometimes that are for very specific tasks. But when you have that through a network of universities, suddenly that task is something that can be used, you know, in multiple locations. So with that, I think really it's about designing tools for very specific tasks and making sure that they're, you know, freely available, they're publicly accessible, because then someone might come across that tool and use it in a different circumstance. You may not have thought out, but it allows, you know, we've seen this happen already with some of the tools we've been developing, and you can find those on the website. And again, I'd highly recommend the Bellingcat Toolkit, because there's loads of stuff on there that's you may not realize. And with the AI abilities of that, it's very, very easy to find tools. Just ask it a question and it'll see what it can do for you.
Yeah, I put a link to the toolkit earlier in the chat, so please do scroll up to find that. Thomas said the New York Times piece searching for 2,000-pound bomb craters was a really cool application of AI. Same with their piece finding additional locations of that Chinese spy balloon in satellite imagery. I haven't come across those pieces, but I will definitely have a look at those. If you have the link, Thomas, please do drop it in the chat. Keep your questions coming. We've got about 15 minutes left. This is a question we get quite a lot, actually. But I'm going to ask it because it obviously it comes with the name. Do you have much experience using OSINT in the info security realm? And do you think that OSINT skills in journalism and info security are interchangeable for the most part?
Well, I think you can learn a lot from how you need to secure your own stuff from, you know, observing what we do in our investigation. I mean, we've plenty of people in through not just their presence online, but the presence of their family members online, for example. I mean, the amount of kind of corrupt Russians we found, and because of their, you know, family members' social media posts, you know, showing their holidays and their sports card, was I think quite useful. I think it can really kind of help you, but by understanding what you can do to other people, it can actually help you understand what can be done to you. So it's kind of just something you learn as you go, that, oh, actually, maybe I shouldn't have such a public Facebook profile. Maybe I shouldn't have all my friends connected. Maybe I shouldn't accept all those friend requests. You know, just so many little things that you learn from doing the process itself. I like to think, you know, I have quite a large online presence, but I also am quite locked down in terms of what is available about my family, for example. So I think you can get that balance. I think sometimes it's like you can't have any public presence whatsoever. You've got to take yourself off the internet, so you're completely hidden. It's more about kind of having a balance and understanding, you know, where the weaknesses are. And that comes through exploiting the weaknesses of other people.
Galen has just shared that New York Times post, so thank you for popping that in. I'll put all of the links, by the way, in the description of the podcast recording. Silver Knife asked earlier, the book was published in 2021, referring to We Are Bellingcat, which was not that long ago. Bellingcat at the time had 18 staff. Roughly how many are there now? And why do people think you have a staff of hundreds?
So over 30, I think we're close to 40 at the moment. We've got people kind of joining fairly frequently as well. So a lot of it is expanding our admin team at the moment because, for a big organization, you need a lot of admin. I think early on when it was just me and the volunteers, I would be kind of talking to funders who just assumed that I must have millions in funding and hundreds of staff because of the kind of impact, the work that we're doing, which is really annoying because I had barely any money and no staff apart from myself. So I think a big part of it is we are kind of part of a community. We have this model. We call it the Bellingcat onion. I don't know if that's what the term we're going to keep on using, but it's kind of this layered thing where at the center we have, you know, the Bellingcat team, close collaborators, you know, the people we have like day-to-day contact with, contractors, and that's really kind of the center of it. Then we have the next layer, which is really people who we aren't necessarily working with every single day, but they're, you know, part of our close-knit community. It could be, you know, the people on the Discord server who are part of our GAP team, the Global Authentication Project team, for example. And those are the people we can kind of direct in. So that's kind of the controlled layers, I would say, where we can design projects around that. We understand what resources we have. But then there's a layer beyond that, which is kind of like this Discord community where we aren't telling you what to do, but stuff comes from you. We interact with you and that can turn into stories itself. But there's also within that, you know, journalists we may work with on and off here and there, depending on if there's a project in the area which they're interested, you know, partners in the NGO space that depending on the project you might approach. And then you kind of have the broader online open source community. And with that community, that's more just people who aren't generally engaged with Bellingcat on a one-to-one basis, but they see what we put out. They might respond to that in some way. And when you're thinking about, you know, the work we do at Bellingcat, it's sometimes how do we engage all those levels of that community? So, you know, for example, when we are having the investigation into the oil spill, the Trinidad and Tobago case, that came from the community. Then we kind of brought that into the center. So, you know, Logan worked on that. The editors worked on that to turn that into something that could be published. But once that was published, then that broader community engaged with it and actually came up with more things to investigate. So we could have this kind of repeated cycle of investigation and publication that, helps us, you know, just engage with that topic in the long term and really have a big impact, really, considering where that's story could have gone. It could have just been, oh, an oil spill, no one does anything about, you know, they're left to clean it up themselves. And now we have the engagement from the United Nations and actually, you know, the assurance, maritime insurance and all that because of that work. And for me, that's kind of like the ideal model of how we would work with our community, because it's, you know, allow the community to work on the things that interest them, but turning that into something that can be published that then has an impact that allows us to create these cycles of investigation and publication and impact.
Okay, we have so many questions and so little time now. So I'm going to ask some questions that I think will need to further conversation. So Scoot asks a question that we get quite a lot, actually, and a couple of the members of the chat have also started talking about it. How essential do you think it is to learn command line tool stuff? They are a mystery to many OSINTers, and where would you suggest starting to get feet wet? Do you know how to use the confine of it?
A little bit. I don't think it's necessary at all. It's a useful skill to have, and I would learn it when you have a specific reason to use it on something. If you learn programming, great, that's fine. It's great you're learning it. But I don't think there's ever been an investigation where there have been some, but it's not like to do open source investigation, you must know how to do command line stuff. But it's a really useful skill to have, and if you're inclined to learn it, then we do have resources. Galen, I believe, has a video that explains some of the stuff that we do with it. We have our GitHub, so you can start using some of the tools there. There's various websites as well that now can teach you things like Python as well. There's so many resources available if you want to learn that kind of thing, but it's really not essential for any open source investigation, starting off for open source investigation. I would say it's more, in my mind, an advanced skill, if you've already got that because of your backgrounds, that's great. You can start thinking about how can I use this in open source investigation and maybe teach us a thing or two in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Gillen's written in the chat, command line tools can be really powerful, but can also get in the way. I really recommend learning a bit about what command line tools can do to decide if you need to invest the time in learning them. If you're interested about using tech, we have a series of videos on our YouTube. We also have a bunch of Jupyter notebooks, which let you do some command line tricks without all the hard work. There's still a bit of work, though. And do check out those Jupyter notebooks. There's actually a guide on how to use them as well on the website, which is really, really useful. Right, a couple of minutes left. Salome asked, I think some nonprofits are resistant to using AI for OSINT for data security reasons. Is there a responsible way to use it while protecting data as much as possible?
Well, I mean, it's like the large language model we use on the toolkit. It's for a very specific purpose and to help guide people to it. I think it's more that a lot of people are concerning that pointing it towards very, very large data sets. I, for example, experimented with building a model around reports on chemical weapon use, taking the OPCW reports, putting them into a model. I kind of just got bored halfway through, but it was working quite effectively. I think maybe when you're dealing with large amounts of documentation that isn't sensitive, it could be very, very useful. When it starts becoming about stuff that is sensitive, then I think you need to be kind of more careful with the way you apply it. And I can see why there is resistance towards it, but I think an element of that is also maybe a bit of ignorance towards how that kind of stuff works.
And then this question's a little bit about Bellingcat's attraction to the world, basically. Falface said, as someone that is quite technical, I've noticed that a lot of your material is designed for people with absolutely no technical knowledge. What is it about what Bellingcat does that attracts who wouldn't normally be interested in technical work in that way?
I think there's a kind of element of kind of mystery and discovery, which I think is appealing to a lot of people. I mean, part of the reason I found it so appealing to begin with is because I was discovering stuff that no one else had figured out. I was like the first person to figure out, yes, this video is definitely filmed in this location, or, you know, oh, this shows this thing happening in this place. And I think there's something quite exciting and appealing about that. And I think really when you think about geolocation, I mean, if you want to go down to the basic, it's spot the difference for adults. And, you know, even some children can get involved. You know, it's something that I think is actually quite accessible. Things, you know, we use satellite imagery all the time. In many cases, I'm sure people who haven't even thought about open source investigation have used, you know, satellite imagery to figure out how they're going to get to some appointment they're going to get to. They say, oh, I shouldn't go that way because, you know, there's not a pathway there. I've gone to Google Street View to look and it's actually a country lane. I shouldn't walk down there. That kind of thing. A lot of these skills are actually things you would use in your day-to-day life. You just use them in a different context, so you don't think of them in terms of investigation. But in a way, if you're figuring out, oh, can I get down this country lane to this place I want to go to, and is there a path? You've done a little investigation where you've been looking on Google Street View to check it. But it's just kind of the recontextualizing that into, you know, what is the outcome of that? Because it's not just about, you know, finding out where you're going.
Okay, last few questions very quickly. Skeptic, who is a new person in the server, so welcome, has asked, have you ever found a surprising or funny piece of information by accident during an investigation?
Well, I think like everything to do with all the Skrifles and the Russian assassination stuff was every single part of that was a surprise at how kind of dumb it was. I think my favorite one there was a report in the Daily Mail. There was a young woman who said she had met one of the Skrifle suspects and told him where he was in the Czech Republic and had asked him to, they kind of were flirting and she said, oh, if you want to get in touch, contact me on Facebook. And in parallel to that, we had discovered a Facebook page. I think it was a Ruslan Bosharov. And there was one photograph on it. And it was a picture taken in the square of the capital of the Czech Republic. And he had created it on the day and he had landed in that country on part of one of his espionage missions. I think it was when they were looking at blowing up the arms depots in the Czech Republic. So what we had was this Facebook page he had created to hook up this young woman whilst he was on a super secret spy mission, and we were able to actually confirm when the photograph was taken using we looked at all the photographs from tourists of that location. You could actually establish the day it was taken on based off the position of things like market stalls, windows being open on a certain pattern. So we could show it was kind of funny that he landed, you know, met this girl, thought, I'll take a photo of the square and create a Facebook page so I can hook up with her.
How do you feel about Bellingcat turning 10? And are you happy with the current position of the organization?
I think I'm very lucky to be able to do this as my job. I think it's been wonderful over the years to see Bellingcat grow. I mean, it's really been down to the effort of a lot of people. I think, I think I'll especially say Desi Damianova, who's our business director. She has been essential in creating Bellingcat in what it is today. I mean, the research that we do is obviously important, but behind that research requires a lot of finance, admin, business work that was beyond me. Had I've done it by myself, I'd probably be in jail now for tax evasion or something like that. I just would have accidentally forgot to pay tax money or something ridiculous like that. Because of that, Bellingcat is in a really, really secure position as an organization. Funding is always a struggle because, things have become difficult in the NGOs funding space just because, in the Netherlands, for example, the government has cut a lot of funding to NGOs that they were providing. I think that's going to happen with the US and with what's happening with USAID. And even if you aren't receiving money from governments like that, it still has an impact on your organization because then you have more people seeking that money. But because of the work that's been done over the years, it's made Bellingcat really kind of quite financially secure. I mean, that's not to say don't donate because we always need money, but it means that if there's another COVID, that we aren't going to be running around worrying that we're going to shut down overnight because we don't have any money, which was what happened last time it was COVID. I just find myself that I'm very fortunate to be able to every single day do the work of Bellingcat because I think it's something that really matters. But it's also something that lots of people can get involved with, that it's not just about me or the organization, it's about the community. And I think that's something that's really wonderful.
Yes, give it up for the backbone of Bellingcat, Desi, please do. Everyone in the chat has loved this session. In fact, one person's asked if we can do this every week. I don't think you have time to do that, but I'm really glad that everybody really enjoyed this session and has learned a lot. Last question, and this is from a community member. They asked, what is your favorite and what is an underrated Frank Zappa song that Brown Moses can recommend?
Oh, God. Underrated and favorite. I really like the album Cruising with Ruben and the Jets, which a lot of Frank Zappa fans. When I got my medal, the Nine Mayhem medal, someone asked a similar question and the entire audience was confused. So you may not get this, but Cruising with Ruben and the Jets, Frank Zappa was a huge fan of 1950s doo-wop music, but he was also very good at slightly tweaking the music to kind of satirize the form itself, which is something that Zappa did a lot. So he did an entire doo-wop album that is really like, it sounds really close to what you'd expect from doo-wop, but it's been slightly tweaked in a way that kind of satirizes the form, which I really, really enjoy. And in my mind, that's like one of the purest versions of him doing that through his music. So that's the one I really like. If you're listening, going to listen to it now, you're going to wonder what the hell I'm talking about. But if you get it, you'll get it.
Amazing. Maybe you can drop the link in the chat for anyone who wants to have a listen to that. And thank you so much, Elliot, for joining us today. And thank you, everybody who's attended today's Stage Talk and all the Stage Talks throughout this year. We'll be back in January with some stellar ones. So please tune in then. But thank you so much for all of your time. And it's been really fun speaking to you.
It's great. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.